28. Good grief. I kept my emotions in check during the pulping. It wasn't easy, but you draw on all your experience, and I've been attending funerals since I was 8. In recent years, I'd been to the send-offs of Tony Hayes, Chief Commissioning Editor of BBC Television, Chris Feather, Chief Commissioning Editor of BBC Television, Mum and Dad, my mum and dad, and the racist mother of the woman who works for me. Don't know name. In the case of the latter, I immediately gave my assistant 36 hours off. I swung by the hospital to explain the terms and conditions to her. I'm giving you 36 hours off, whether you like it or not. She didn't reply, which could have been rudeness, but was more likely to be because her mother's body was still warm, I reasoned. What was that? Can all those hours be taken in one go? I knew she'd said no such thing, but I was keen to try to make this as interactive as possible. Good question, I continued. No, they mustn't be used all in one go. Instead, the allotted hours may be taken at any time in the next month, but in units of no more than 3 hours. This system, flexi-grief you might call it, may sound odd, but I knew the blues could strike at any moment. Just like a young chimp raised by humans, your grief can seem totally under control. But one day that grief will reach adolescence and dish out a frenzied and unprovoked simian beatdown, I explained as we accompanied Mum to the mortuary. Her mum, not mine. What would happen if a person took a straight 36 hours off, but then grief hit when that person was back at work doing, I don't know, her employer's quarterly underwear shop? You can't very well just wipe your nose on the ice-white cellular briefs and carry on as if nothing's happened. Marx offers a wonderfully forgiving returns policy, but even they would draw the line at snotty grandies. And how glad I was that I'd insisted on spreading those 36 hours across the month, because we had problems a couple of weeks after the death. My assistant was busy double-checking my Sainsbury's receipt for any instances of overcharging. I just saw a flicker in her face. I leaned over. Are you okay? Yes, I thought they diddled you on the kidney beans, but no, I don't mean that. You looked like you were about to cry. I demonstrated this by doing a sad face, then lifting my fist to my eye and waggling it. No, I'm fine. Good, I just wanted to check on you, I said in an arm-around-the-shoulder kind of way, although there was absolutely no physical contact. Because your lip was wobbling, I thought you were, you know, thinking of things you should have said. Suddenly, my assistant burst into tears. So she had been upset after all, the little fibber. I didn't mind, though. She was a mum down. I pointed to a box. Tuck into those tissues. They're laced with aloe vera, so you can be as rough on your nose as you want. In the end, she found the whole thing harder than anticipated. I'd said she could take 36 hours overall, but when we totted it up at the end of the month, it came to almost 40. In other words, my assistant loved her mum 12% more than I'd calculated. That was fine, though. Not a problem at all. Ultimately, you can't precisely gauge amounts of sadness. And I actually wanted to help with the healing process, not least because it was dragging me down a bit. I got her straight back to work. To start the healing process, I had her buy and assemble, then disassemble and return a gas barbecue. A Phoenix stainless steel 4-burner. It's actually a lovely bit of kit. And with a cooking surface of 70 centimetres times 45 centimetres, it allows the adventurous host to try his hand at any type of food. Play it safe with sausages, or become the talk of the town with a delicious spatchcocked chicken. The choice is yours. What she didn't know is that I already had one. I was just trying to keep her mind off things, namely her racist mum, or lack thereof. But every cloud has a silver lining, and I suppose my assistant's loss is the black community's gain. Not that life is ever so clear-cut. She may have been one of the most profoundly prejudiced people this side of Eugène Terre Blanche, but she also cooked an excellent shepherd's pie. Shades of grey. Everybody shades of grey. Both of my own parents are also thoroughly dead. I have to be honest and say I wasn't too cut up when Papa passed on. Our relationship had been so complex I could write a book on it. What do you reckon, HarperCollins? Seriously, let me know because I can easily turn round a mislit book. E.g., 1968, Summer of Hate, brackets for me. Or Locked in the Larder. For a time, I was determined not to shed a tear over him, so if I ever felt myself welling up, useful tip this, I'd just think of all the bad things about him, and I soon felt better. It's not what he would have wanted, but in a way, that helped. The first and worst death of the lot was Mum's. It's hard to describe what it's like to lose your mother, but HarperCollins have insisted I try. Their suggestion is that I think back to how I felt at the time of her death and use words that relate or convey those emotions. So, where to begin? Well, unlike someone else's mum, she certainly wasn't racist. She really didn't agree with any of that stuff. In fact, she hated racists as much as she hated homosexuals. My relationship with her went way back. Although we weren't close from day one, during those long, hard months in the womb, she'd been less my mother and more my house. I didn't interact with her, I just lived inside her. And then, when I made good my escape from her cervix, see chapter one, she'd become less my mum and more my canteen. Although her teats weren't much of a chef, it was milk every day, for goodness sake. But it was as the years rolled on, as I began to crawl, walk, and then express myself through dance, that things began to blossom. She was my friend, my cheerleader, my protector-in-chief. And we remained close until the onset of my difficult adolescent years. I remember we entered choppy waters pretty soon after my balls dropped. By the time I was 16, our relationship had broken down to such an extent that I'd rarely even let her do my blackheads. Yet, when I asserted my independence and emerged from my mum's considerable shadow, I mean this metaphorically, although she was fat. The poor woman looked like someone had blown her up with a bike pump. Our relationship began to improve. In my BBC days, no one was more proud of my success. She would absolutely insist on watching Knowing Me, Knowing You if she was at home when it was on. It was different when I returned to radio. She didn't listen to Norfolk Knights, on too late, Up with the Partridge, on too early, or Mid-Morning Matters, dead. But it didn't matter. I knew she'd only ever wanted the best for me, and I'm sure the same is true today. If there's a radio in heaven, I'm sure she'll be up there listening, providing my show doesn't clash with Today, Start the Week, or The Archers, which is what God would listen to. Sadly, I can't say the same for Father, who is probably in a different place. Hell. To preserve her dignity, I'd rather not say what she died from, but suffice to say the family was forced to ask some rather uncomfortable questions about what she used to get up to in her spare time. When they'd finally brought her body back from Hull, don't ask, and the coroner had concluded his post-mortem, long story, we were free to arrange the kind of funeral we knew she would have wanted, minus the open casket. Believe me, you don't want to know. With Dad in no fit state to do anything, I agreed to say a few words at the service. I'd felt absolutely fine in the hearse. In fact, I enjoyed the ride. It was a mint-condition Daimler Laudalette Vendome Plat, with slide-out occasional seats, allowing generous room for up to five mourners who would easily drown out the hushed whisper of the smooth straight-six engine. I would have loved to have seen what kind of speed it would have reached on the open road, but the undertaker would not be persuaded, and quite right too. All in all, though, very nice. But as soon as I got into the church, it all went wrong. I went to pieces like a dropped jigsaw. After a few minutes of being cuddled by great-aunt Susie, we'd managed to reduce my crying down to a manageable sob. Then it was time to give the speech. I took a deep breath, gritted, grat, my teeth, and then just spoke from the heart. I stand before you all today to talk about a woman I can describe in just two words. My mummy. But when I started recounting how she used to let me lick the spoon when she was making cakes or gravy, it all got too much. I became so grief-stricken I barely knew what I was saying. For a while I thought I was broadcasting. Uncle Pete said that at one point I tried to introduce Cool for Cats by Squeeze. I can't recall much about the wake either. To be honest, I was in a bit of a daze. I remember eating a great many chicken drumsticks and someone coming up to me and telling me I mustn't forget to have some fibre too. He said the last thing I wanted was to be bereaved and bunged up. And he was right. To this day, it's advice I always pass on to mourners who I see failing to eat sufficient roughage in the immediate aftermath of the death of a loved one. After the burial, things got slowly better. For the first couple of days, I used to visit the grave every day. My schedule soon got in the way, though, so then I'd start sending my assistant as my graveside representative. She was visiting her mum anyway, and the bus connection between the two graveyards were really good considering how far apart they were. Besides, I reasoned that as a believer, my assistant derived more meaning from graveside grieving than I did. Not that I'm a non-believer as such. I'm pretty open-minded about the possibility of an afterlife, although I always think of heaven as a kind of members club for do-gooders. White beanbags, 24-hour room service, fat babies with wings pointing at other fat babies playing compact harps. Don't get me wrong, it's good stuff. If you find it comforting, go there. I don't go down to the cemetery at all these days, unless I happen to be passing, in which case I'll take flowers. The beauty of her headstone is that it's located on the main thoroughfare through the graveyard, so if I'm pushed for time, I can open my passenger side window and throw the flowers out without stopping. That might sound crass, but in many ways it's a tribute to Mum, because she was a real stickler for punctuality. Not that the flowers always had to land in the right place. Quite often they'd end up on the grave of Dan, loving father and loyal husband, Faversham. Occasionally other mourners would see this happening and frown. I can only assume they think I'm a predatory gay with a fetish for the dead, and I know that would have made Mum chuckle.